My name's Barry Essen. I work for a company called Arica. We're organising this tour, amongst other things. Thanks very much for coming along. This tour is a... what is it? It's kind of a series of events in which we visit overlooked or unobserved corners of our towns and cities, places that have an elusive kind of atmosphere or a unity of ambience that allows them to hold some kind of special meaning for us as we've gone around and looked at them. In many cases, they're also places in which we feel that you can feel a sense of privacy in public. Sense of privacy in public is very important, I think. It's also, in some level, analogous to the idea of musical performance and the fact that a musical performance is something, or any kind of performance, is something that's very personal or private that you do publicly for others. So we're situating performances in these kind of locations around our towns and cities. The event today will take place mainly in this building, but it also leaves here on what we've clocked is exactly a 7-minute walk, so it's not too far, and then we're just going to leave you in the middle of a housing estate and you can find your own way home. So having said that, is there anything else I need to tell you? This is probably where I ask Brian normally. Is there anything else? Oh, thanks to our funders who pay for all of this. They are listed in the back of that little booklet. So the first thing we're going to do, we're going to go up to what were intended to be luxury penthouses at the top of this building, and our kind of map theoretician and psychogeographer who we've got with us on this tour is going to give you a little bit of context before we go on to some musical performances. So perhaps if you'd like to follow Bryony and Sean a bit.
Space. In the middle of nowhere.
Huh?
In the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere, in the
center of Cumbernauld, of course.
I'll give you a license of pronunciation. I'm an ex-native.
That's true. I've been called for that many times in the last week.
Can you all hear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, it's an extraordinary privilege to be able to talk in this building, which stands like a fulcrum in the debates about and the history of modernism in the 20th century. A debate which one might have thought was over, but which the so-called new modernism has brought back, so that the building once again finds itself being thought and rethought for what it said, or seemed to have said, or might have said, and perhaps for what it could say. A few days ago at Easter House, I traced two divergent histories of psychogeography. One deriving from the work of the situationist Peter Ward in the 50s in Paris, and another deriving from the work of the urban planner Kevin Lynch at MIT in Cambridge, about the same time, actually, in the later 50s. Although they actually begin the work that's of real interest today in 1953. These two traditions are very different in character, as I said. One drives from an artistic avant-garde, the situationist, and develops an understanding of the city and the built environment as a function of desire and as a function of passion, and yet is connected to the Lynchian effort in a variety of ways. One, it was concerned to establish the fact or the reality that passion and desire are not subjective things. They have an objective existence, and they, as such, have to be taken into account in the construction and the destruction of our environment. These are real things. They're not fleeting fancies that individuals experience and cannot be shared, but they're real. Kevin Lynch was also interested in understanding how people as a group understand their physical environment, and he too wanted to establish this on an objective basis, that is to say, a basis that transcended individual and idiosyncratic readings of the environment, to reach for a reading of the environment that would have some kind of validity across groups. And in the beginning, I don't think Lynch differentiated among groups, but later his work became much more subtle, and he began looking at the way readings of environments vary with class and with ethnicity and with transport mode, education, and other kinds of things. His, of course, is an academic in an engineering school. There's a very different interpretation and understanding of what objectivity and the relationship between humans and the built environment could mean from that of DeBoer. Commitment to the idea that the only people who could really validly talk about the environment were the people who really lived in it. In both cases, although one approached it from the perspective of an artist, and God forbid that anyone should characterize DeBoer as an elite. In fact, I can feel him spinning his grave as I even connect those two words in the same sentence. But he certainly wasn't. He was a really particularly, belonged to an extremely small class, not only of situations which were never numerous, but to a people, a kind of people dedicated to a kind of pursuit with a fervor and determination that really made him kind of extraordinary. Lynch was, of course, a college-educated academic professor at maybe the most prestigious engineering schools in the world, also a member of some kind of an elite, although Lynch, too, did not like to think about himself in those terms. But despite that, both of these people were really committed to understanding what ordinary citizens walking around in the world made of their world in their very different way. DeBoer through his model of the derive,
and the movement through the city of small groups of people, and Lynch through a series of questionnaires and map drawing exercises and so forth. He also sketched how that latter concern of Lynch's led to the kind of psychogeography that was established at Clark University in the 60s, and to which I was an heir, and which became deeply concerned with the kinds of issues that this building evokes in a peculiarly powerful way. One of the things we were really interested in coming out of Lynch was how people find their way around. I don't know how many maps we collected of people's walks from one place to another, of people's movements through shopping malls. I used to go to state fairs and capture people coming out of fun houses and ask them to describe the nature of their experience inside in an attempt to uncover some of the constraints on construal of an environment. Well, this building raises these issues just dramatically. I don't know how you all came into it, but I mean, this is an insanely complicated building. And not only is it insanely complicated, it raises other kinds of psychogeographic issues that arose in the context of programming for psychiatric facilities, which were what kind of things you wanted to avoid, what kind of things you sort of wanted to put into facilities where people who were not in the control of their reading of the environment that we imagine that we have might, you know, find desirable or undesirable. Benches, for example, cantilevered off the wall without legs, are not going to be sat on by paranoid people, and so forth. This kind of hallway, which was very common in large mental institutions, causes people who are already sane to go completely nuts. But if you know, think about trying to program a psychiatric facility, you've got things like this. Windows, identical windows. I've been here before. Will I ever get out? And so forth and so on. He says, "Immediately." All right. So this building is like no one could have designed this building who had really thought very carefully about how it was going to be used by people in their ordinary, ongoing daily life. Another place this shows up is in the programming involving its original openness. This building was originally open. Radically open to the environments, so all the walkways on the lower levels, the interpenetration of the parking and the transport spine, this was all open. And of course, we have powerful weather in Scotland, and the weather made it absolutely impossible for people to use the space. Did you grow up here? Did you have those? Yeah. You know the building before all the walkways
absolutely.
Were closed?
Yeah.
And it was?
It was pretty miserable in the winter. If it rained or wind blew, which it does a lot in Cumberland, it was shitty. But the building also, this part of the building on its own, stand alone, was a lot less complex. It's when they built phase two across the road that the complexity came in because they interconnected multiple levels. So you had to know not only the building you were in, but the level you were on to then work out how you could get to where you wanted to go. And you could get lost as customary.
There you go. A native's testimony. Exactly. And these are also the sorts of questions that Lynch-oriented psychogeography was really sort of organized to try and deal with. How could you actually make a building that did two things? One, have the interest that we associate with, let's say, medieval townscapes. Or, you know, it's not all rationalized, but you've got these breaks and these turns and these twisted that add, you don't necessarily think you're going to know where you're going, but at the same time allows you to add up into a coherent image that does give you a sense of order and control. So it's a sort of fusion of visual or perceptual, more broadly speaking, perceptual surprise and interest combined with a sort of cognitive structure that gives you security to move around the space very, very comfortably. This is just like the opposite of that. This has got like maximum perceptual underload and maximal cognitive dissonance. There's, I don't know, I mean, you just said it. I mean, exactly. So there's that. There's the failure to take into account the weather. Now, that's not true, because originally there was going to be a break wall built along the west that would have kept some of the weather in any event, although not all of it, off of the building. And issues like that, where part of the plan wasn't built, and because that part of the plan wasn't built, other parts of the plan had to be modified, make it really difficult today to look at this building in its current form and try to say what was going on back in the 60s when this building was constructed. Because the sort of ideals, and I think we could go on, by the way, and just detail the ways in which this building violates psychogeographic norms on both sides of the psychogeographic divide pretty consistently, which is not to say that De Board and Crewe wouldn't have found some really cool spaces in here as well, because there are. And in a way, this is a totally cool space if you want sort of a Solaris spaceship, otherworldly kind of experience.
Do you know what it was originally designed to look like? This space was an ocean liner.
An ocean liner or an aircraft carrier.
Ocean liner was the original intent. My next door neighbor that lived in Cumbernauld was the chief town planner for Cumbernauld. Mm-hmm. So I've seen the original pictures of this. As you would see it as you drove past on the main road, the idea was to give Cumbernauld an identity.
Right. And it's also got elements of Italian town villages and so forth and so on. The city on the hill its ideals, however, that motivated the construction of this thing were not all that far removed from those of Lynch and those of De Board. I think the intentions in all three of these like little nexi of consideration are to make really wonderful spaces where people can live. And then I think what this raises is what is the problem that this building sort of brings to our attention, given the fact that it comes out of a sort of Garden City mentality to begin with, but a Garden City mentality that had already profited from Garden Cities and the criticism of Garden Cities that said, no, look, they're too flat, the densities are too low, it's not very urban, they're soulless and monotonous. And so it's a Garden City that's sort of being constructed as a new town center with higher density, and the housing was supposed to be quite dense around here. Again, a promise that wasn't completely and certainly not fulfilled any longer at all. So it was sort of coming out of the Garden City set of ideals, but profiting from the set of ideals that said, no, that's not urban enough, so you've got that set of ideals brought into it as well. And then a whole set of social welfare ideals that are also operating here that have to do with the fact that Cumbernauld, is that right, Bevan? Is a response to housing problems in Glasgow to begin with. So there are all these sets of wonderful intentions that are somehow floating around. And what would De Board say about these? Well, De Board would say bullshit is what he would say. You know, you can't make a great environment out of good intentions. All you're going to get is shit, which in a way is what I think he would think about this building as an example of. The arrogance in a way that one man or two men, Hugh Wilson and his crew, and Bob Corbett, is that who the actual architect, you know, that they, with the support of a few university faculty experts, would be able to, in fact, create an entire town center. And not only create an entire town center, but create an entire town center in a single building. And not just in a single building, but the one that was vertically zoned to separate functions out, and that at the same time was responding to prevailing ideas, or not, I should hardly say prevailing, but new ideas about megastructures and the new brutalism, and hence the concrete exterior of this building. You take that set of conflicted things, and they're going to roast in a single individual who's going to produce an environment that would be fit for human beings. I think that even at the time, that was a kind of hubris that was already 20 to 30 years out of date. And probably was never, you know, all that much in fashion. So where does that leave us? I don't know, frankly, with respect to this building and what it has to say, and what it has to say about the kind of ideals that motivate psychogeography in the first place, because those ideals are not all that distinct from the kind of ideals that motivated the construction of this building in the first place, which now wants the psychogeographies which want now to come and deconstruct this building, reflect on the building, and find in the building's refuge corners, which we're going to descend and hear music in very shortly, spaces of a kind of ambience and frisson, excitement and interest that we can't find in the Antonin Center next door, the completely anodyne but
highly popular. All you have to do is just step over there and then step down to the center down here. And that's loaded with front-end brand name stuff and happy shoppers right and left. And that's not what you're going to find downstairs at all, and probably never did. And certainly not in the Tesco next door to that, which is, I was in there earlier today, literally thronged. You could barely walk around. It was so jammed with shopping humans. I don't know where psychogeography stands with respect to that shopping mall and where it stands with respect to the Tesco. I'm sure it is more likely to be antagonized by them than it is by this building. And particularly today, when the building at least leaves us with remnants of its idealism, like shipwrecked fragments that we can come to grips with in some way. Coming up, driving up to the building from this end and seeing this giant thing stuck out, looks like a candy bar of some kind, stuck out and standing on a slender pillar with these portholes in it. It's like no one has ever seen anything like this before, and no one ever will again. And here it is, a monument that we can sort of revel in and roll around in. I don't know, I think mostly what this building does and what psychogeography would ask us to do in this building is just to reflect on where we are and where we think we are and how we respond to our environment and how we can transform that response into some kind of positive action that will make our own lives in any event more interesting or genuine or thanks. Where are we going?
Follow me.
Sure.
Just go all the way through the recorder.
I'll do it.
Sorry about that.
It's on hold at the moment, so none of the controls will work.
Okay, that's cool.
Just flick on the switch there.
Brilliant, thank you.
And levels are there.
Great, thanks. Excellent. Can I ask you two, are these?
Sorry?
These are we're making a recording of everything. You just need to wear them. Would you be able to do that?
Mm-hmm.
Are you going to stick that in your pocket?
Thank you.
Okay. So how do who's telling him to start? Okay. This way. Thing. Just want to let Matt get away.
Why is he not running?
I don't know. And that's scientifically proven now, I think, yeah. Does Tamio know how to get over here?
Yeah, he'll be okay.
You sure?
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Do you want me to go and get him?
Do you want to just go to the back and see if he's okay. Caught up with us? Is that alright? We were in the bar in the Queens in Dundee with Ikuro Takahashi, just having a chat and stuff, and I was asking him about what other Japanese musicians think of him, and he's like, oh, the worst is Yu Ishihara. he thinks I'm the bottom of the underground, and he means it as an insult. I think it's a compliment.
What, Yuichiro thinks that about Kamio Shirishi?
No, Takahashi.
Hiro Takahashi?
Yeah, and then so Takahashi says, if I'm the bottom of the underground, then Shirashi is the top of the bottom of the underground.
Wow, it's just so weird when you hear all the talk, because it's like any kind of scene.
Yeah.
It's quite unified, but everyone's bitching.
Yeah, totally. He was like, Ishihara wants to make music. I don't want to make music.
Yeah. Yeah. Nanjo Akihiro describes you, Ishihara, as high-rise roadie.
Really?
Yeah. Fuck.
I think he's really underdocumented, like what he thinks and stuff, and what he did for a long time. The only thing I know him doing in the 80s was that band Taco with Toshi Tanaki, Tanaka, and he did that like year-long series of concerts and stuff as well. So me and Sean are going to sit down with him tomorrow morning and just try, like on tape, kind of quiz him about some stuff.
Got to ask about Fushitsusha as well, of course.
Yeah, early. He was in Haiju Kidan for like 2 weeks as well, apparently.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Wow.
None of them will know what I'm talking about, though. My pronunciation's so bad. They're like, Haiju Kidan?
Really?
Talking about like, Haiju Kaidan.
Haiju Kaidan, is that how you pronounce
Haiju
it?
Haiju Kaidan, yeah.
Wow. There's no document that really exists of Shirishi playing in that kind of style either as well.
No, not really. Even the stuff that you hear. Well, I mean, I guess he plays with a lot of kind of noisier guys in New York now. You know, he doesn't just play with Sean. You know, he's in a band with Licht, and he's
a band with Licht, really?
Yeah, and he plays with a lot. So I guess he's maybe.
He's on a couple of no name blues band albums. Really.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, well, Michiko, that's his partner.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Together?
Yeah.
Really? Wow.
Michiko Takahashi.
Well, she's apparently him then.
He wanted to see if we could bring her along, but we didn't really have enough cash.
Is it Matt Hainer or is it Dave Nuss that's saying, like, even like no neck, don't really know anything about her?
Oh, really?
She started coming to the rehearsals and going and disappeared and no one's anything about her personal life or anything else about her, and she never talks.
Really?
Yeah, apparently.
Wow.
Even he thinks it's totally weird.
Oh, no, fuck, I always forget which way it is from here. Hang on. It's down this way.
Has it ever been? So we slow down a bit and let people catch up. Oh fuck, they all know where we're going.
Yeah, Tamio's been totally immense all tour. Really playing, really, like Sean, who's played with him for 13 years, is just saying he's being really ferocious and really, like he hasn't heard him play this loud for like a decade.
Incredible. I wonder what it is that's going on.
I think.
I mean, yeah. He never really gave way to those nades. I mean, some people would have, like, jokingly done a duet with that guy with the grass or something, but
he's like, fuck you, man, blade of fucking grass.
Yeah. It's so cool. Because it could really have devolved into one of those kind of just crappy artsy, you know, let's play with the locals.
Yeah. No, he's totally fearless.
Totally blew him in his face, man.
We did a recording session for the BBC, and he said, and after, there was this gull, like, swooping him and, like, dive bombing his head all the time. And I went up afterwards and said, Tamio, do you see that gull? And he said, yeah. When I walked into the space, I recognised him as an aggressive gull. So I went for him. So he's just been fucking going at this.
Better watch this guy. What is this space we're going to now?
Well, you'll find out, I guess.
Is this like a little house in the space?
Yeah. So we'll be keeping up.
So a wire came out this morning with the White House piece.
Oh really?
Yeah, it looks good.
What do the photos look like?
One photo is like a full page, and it's got the Bennett and Best standing like outside of the road, and behind them is just one building which is completely trashed, and then something else off in the back.
Right.
It's outside Edinburgh.
Right, okay.
It's a great picture of William with his totally top unbuttoned, playing the African drums. There's one of Philip, like, totally screaming like this and playing out on it. And there's loads of, like, there's six or seven archival ones that are on one page. And then the last piece of them both sitting on some steps in a coast, a full page, just laughing, and it's such a good picture.
Oh, that's cool, man. Are you pleased with it?
Yeah, I really am. Nick Kane completely hates Savages, the album, and a reviewer.
Really?
Yeah, I think the Wired did that deliberately, so they can have a balanced view.
He's so fucking... What happened to that guy? He's so fucking cynical these days. I don't know.
Right now, like, just can Nick Cain ever give anything a positive review? And can Byron Coley ever give anything a negative review? They're like the two poles. Give them anything, you just know what they're going to say.
Yeah.
Crazy.
Yeah, I don't. He's still ever becoming. Yeah, Nick, I don't know, I don't have much respect for Nick Cain.
You know what? If you hate all that music, then just fucking stop writing about it.
I know, go and get a job at The Guardian with David Stubbs.
Exactly. Why fucking David Stubbs? You're just some cynical asshole. I don't even know why you're involved in music anymore. And it's such a shame because you used to do Opprobrium.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Byron and me, but they went to the opposite extremes. They both did like really amazing, enthusiastic zines. And then they both kind of lost their critical faculties a bit, you know?
Oh, let's slow down a bit, let people catch up. People really strung out.
There's a good primer on like English psychedelic folk by Rob Young though.
Alright.
He's really good, he's got really good choice for that, Clive Stewart.
I wouldn't have thought that would have been his thing.
One woman coming up, wee baby.
You seen Bryony? Has she
not? Aye, she's in there.
Is she? Great.
That's it. Thank you very much for coming along. Oh, that's all right. Thanks for coming down.
Well done.
All right, thank you.
Catch up with you next week.
Yes, how's everything going? Wonderful. Thank you for coming.
Absolutely wonderful. The graffiti down there is absolutely brilliant. That little one. Ein, the sun will shine. Spy, the sun will shine. The one next, fuck the world. Fuck everything. Fuck this. Fuck that. Fuck, etc. Don't judge me. It's just brilliant.
Have you seen the garage next door? It says this garage is owned by Jim Kerr. phone this number.
That's a career highlight. Fantastic. Fantastic. And the speech was really good. It really worked. Mm. Really worked.
Oh, I'm glad. It's kind of a big gamble getting to. It's brilliant.
It's great.
Yeah, it's a bit of a risk kind of getting somebody to kind of talk at one of these events, but I think it's.
Really
people take it on with us, I think we'll see
an exceptionally good use of a Saturday afternoon.
Thanks for coming down. I'll see you soon. Have you got tickets?
I booked one and then I might not use it.
Okay.
I called in today saying I'm not going to use it, so if somebody else wants to have it, then
okay, cool. I don't think we will. It's totally oversubscribed, and the spaces that I want to use are about that big. So, but if you want to come along, come along. Very good. Cheers, mate. Thanks. Kuro, thank you very much. That was fantastic. Did you enjoy that?
Yes. I couldn't reach.
Oh, no. Oh, well, never mind. I didn't think.
Sean is very good.
Sean is very good, yeah.